Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk show. This is David Inge, the host for the program. Glad to have you with us. Well, if you think about all of the organs of the human body, look at the way that they're designed, their functions, how well they work, you have to say that of all of the parts, perhaps the most beautifully engineered thing, maybe one of the most beautifully engineered things in nature, is the human brain. However, thinking that, says our guest for this hour of Focus, you would be wrong. We're talking with David Linden. He is a neuroscientist, professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, and author of a recently published book that we'll be talking about, which he has titled The Accidental Mind. He writes in the book that the brain is not elegantly designed by any means. It is a cobbled together mess, which, amazingly and in spite of its shortcomings, manages to perform a number of very impressive functions. But while its overall function is impressive, its design is not more important. The quirky, inefficient, and bizarre plan of the brain and its constituent parts is fundamental to our human experience. The particular texture of our feelings, perceptions, and actions is derived in large part from the fact that the brain is not an optimized, generic, problem-solving machine, but rather a weird agglomeration of ad hoc solutions that have accumulated throughout millions of years of evolutionary history. The book, The Accidental Mind, is published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press, and it is available now if you'd like to read the book. And certainly if you're someone who, if you're curious about the brain and how it is structured and how it works, this might be a good book for you to look at, because certainly the intention is for it to be a book for a general audience. It is not just for other people who study neuroscience. Questions, of course, are welcome too. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Questions at any point are welcome. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and give us a call. Professor Linden, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
So when people realize that this is your field of study and that you're the kind of fellow who knows a lot about the brain and how it is put together, what is it? What are the things that everybody wants to know, or what are the frequently asked questions about the brain and how it works?
Well, this is something that occurs very frequently in cocktail party and other social situations. And the great thing is that people who don't study the brain have the best questions about it. They don't want to let you off easy. And so some of the questions that I get most frequently are things like, are the brains of gay people and straight people physically different? Why can't I tickle myself is another question. Can I improve my cognitive capacity with dietary supplements? These are some of the most frequent questions I've been asked. Mm.
Well, we can talk a little bit here to start perhaps about basic structure of the brain. But the question about, are the brains of gay people different from the brains of straight people? That's a lot like the question, and I'm sure that people also ask, are the brains of women different from the brains of men? Some people, they want to find some kind of structure that you can point to and you can say, now here's a difference and that it means something. When you look for those kind of differences, you may indeed find them, but then you also have to allow for the fact that if you get any group of people at all together, and if you could really take their brains out, they would be different. How much difference is there simply from one brain to the next if we got 10 people or 20 people or 30 people and we removed their brains and started cutting them up? How much difference would there be just naturally occurring between one person and the next?
Well, quite a bit in a certain realm. So, for example, the total volume of the brain can range in normal people from about 1,100 cubic centimeters to about 1,800 cubic centimeters. Now, the people who have these different size brains generally have the same shape. The relative sizes of the various areas would be preserved, but things are scaled up or scaled down. So there's quite a bit of variation there. And so when you consider these things, usually you're talking about comparing large populations of individuals. It's not that instructive to compare person A with person B. Mm. The other thing that I think is worth saying is that in the human brain, most of what we can do is look at it, particularly while people are alive. And that level of analysis is rather limited. So you can say, well, how big are the various parts of the brain? And that gives you a certain crude level of information. But more information could be derived, for example, if you could know the subtle shapes of the individual nerve cells that constitute the brain, or the particular electrical behavior of individual nerve cells that constitute the brain. So a lot of the variation that might be there between individuals are things that are not easily amenable to measurement.
Hmm. Well, I'm sure that people, if you say, okay, close your eyes and picture the brain, they have seen in a book, no doubt, or maybe have seen a model of what the brain looks like, at least what the outside looks like. You have a sense of what a brain looks like. When you, though, think about what are the major parts, if you take it apart into at least its major constituent parts, and there are maybe, I don't know, six or at least, mm-hmm. What should people know about what are the, just the basic pieces, big pieces that we should talk about?
Well, I think the important thing, rather than giving just a list of the names of parts of the brain, which is not really that interesting, I think what's more interesting is the concept of how the brain is designed. And this is as follows. It turns out that the brain, through evolution, is built more or less like an ice cream cone. And what I mean to say by that is that you build an ice cream cone by putting one scoop on and then another scoop on top and then another scoop on top of that. But as you build the ice cream cone, as you put on the third scoop, you don't change the first and second scoops. You more or less leave them alone. And that's more or less how the brain has evolved. So if you look at the lowest parts of the brain, and when I say lowest, I'm meaning both metaphorically lowest in terms of complexity of function and literally lowest in terms of closest to the top of the spinal cord. These are the regions that control very basic functions like our breathing, our heart rate, and our body temperature. And these are the circuits that we, to a large degree, share with animals like, say, frogs and lizards and snakes. So that will be what I would constitute the first scoop. The second scoop involves regions of our brain that control memory storage for facts and events initially, our emotional centers, more complicated regions for controlling certain forms of motion. These are more in the middle part of our human brains, and these are the regions that we share with, say, for example, rats and mice. And then the peak of the brain, both metaphorically in terms of its cognitive function and the portion that is most towards the top and the front of our heads, is the neocortex. Now, rats and monkeys have a neocortex like we do, but ours has become enormously elaborated. And, of course, the neocortex is what gives rise to our fine perceptions, but also, more importantly, our cognitive capacities allowing for language, reasoning, morality, and things of that nature are explicitly human traits.
So as I understand it, I guess the important idea to get across is something, again, to look at it the way that you did, is if indeed you were going to sit down and design a brain, and if you said, all right, at the beginning, we have a relatively simple organism, and the things that we need to control are, as you say, the basic things. We want to make sure that this creature continues to breathe in and out. So we can design, if you want to think about it, we can design a kind of a structure that will regulate that. And that works pretty well, and it does what we need it to do for that organism. Now, if we say, well, I think we'd like to design something a little bit more complicated that will do things that this simple organism doesn't, rather than going back to the drawing board and starting all over again and designing a completely new brain that will do all of the old functions plus the new ones that we want, we just say, well, the old one did that okay. we'll design another part to do the new things, and we'll just stick it on there, and that in fact, that's what evolution has done as we have come across each new set of demands. Rather than starting all the way at the beginning, we keep everything we'd had to that point, and then we'd say, okay, we need some new structures here. This will do. Stick it on.
That's absolutely correct. This was summarized in a wonderful quote from the evolutionary biologist François Jacob, who said, evolution is a tinkerer, not an engineer. The analogy that I like to use to help people understand this is, imagine that your task as an engineer is to develop the latest Formula One race car. And you say, okay, that's fine, I'd like to do that, that's interesting. And then they say, well, actually, there's a hitch. The hitch is, we are going to give you a 1925 Model T, and you have to build your Formula One race car by adding stuff to the Model T, but not taking anything away. And that's more or less what happens in the brain. Extra stuff gets stuck on, but the old stuff doesn't get fundamentally redesigned. And this leads to some very bizarre situations. So, for example, in our brain, we have two separate visual systems, an ancient one and a modern one. We have two separate auditory systems, an ancient one and a modern one. The ancient ones are left over from the neural circuitry that we share with lizards, frogs, and snakes, and we still use it. It hasn't become vestigial. We use it for some very particular purposes, but nonetheless, it's a rather particular design and one that wouldn't occur from designing on a blank sheet of paper.
Mm. Well, that invites the question that if you think of the brain in this way as being this this collection of different structures that are evolutionarily speaking old and new, that in their functions are higher and lower, and that they are separate and yet connected, one wonders how well they actually all work together and whether there are in fact times when they don't.
Well, right. And the thing is that this is not something we're aware of. As we go around out in the world, we're not conscious of the fact that we have two visual systems and two auditory systems. These things are blended in our perception rather seamlessly. But occasionally, some very strange things happen which reveal this. I think one of the most interesting ones is this amazing phenomenon called blind sight. So a number of years ago, Larry Weizkrantz at Oxford realized that in a group of people who were blind as a result of sustaining damage to their visual cortex, that is to say, to their higher visual centers, these folks are utterly blind for all intents and purposes. And he did this the following experiment. He put a letter in their hand, and he had a mailbox with a slit in front of them that was oriented either horizontally or vertically. And he said, okay, I'd like you to guess and just put this letter in the mailbox properly. Now, the blind people said, well, you got to be crazy. I'm utterly blind. I have no basis to make this decision. It'll be completely random. And he said, well, just give it a try anyway. And what he found was not in all people who had damage to the visual cortex, but in a subset, there were some folks who could place the letter in the mailbox at well above chance levels. They didn't do it perfectly, but they did it much, much better than chance. And at first this was very puzzling until they realized that what was happening is that while the modern visual system was utterly destroyed, the ancient visual system, which does not give rise to typical conscious visual awareness, was nonetheless providing enough information to allow these people to make an informed choice and to do it at much better than chance levels. So that is one rather peculiar way in which these two visual systems can be revealed.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is David Linden. He's professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and is the author of a recent book, The Accidental Mind. The subtitle is How Brain Evolution Has Given Us Love, Memory, Dreams, and God. It is published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University. And questions are welcome. We do, in fact, have someone who is ready to go. I'd like to talk with our guest, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. The caller here is on line one and in Champaign. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. Hey, this is real interesting. You said we had two visual systems and two oral systems, sort of.
Yes.
And, well, I'm just curious, this may be a very stupid question, but is there some magic about the number two? Is it possible in some other universe we might have had three or four? With that, I'll let you go and I'll hang up. Thanks.
Well, so that is that's a really interesting question, and I guess what I would say is this. That is, in a way, the number two is a little bit of an arbitrary designation. In other words, we know, that there is one visual system in a place called the optic tectum, the ancient one, and we know that there is another one that is in the neocortex, the modern one. However, there are actually multiple channels of information that are conveyed from the retina to the visual cortex, and it's not what you would call, in engineering terms, serial processing. It's not like one set of signals comes in and then it goes through a number of processing steps. It turns out that visual information comes in a number of different separate channels from different specialized cells in the retina, and that information isn't all mixed up in the visual cortex. That there are particular channels that are designed to extract certain kinds of information. So one rather crude designation that visual scientists use is they call one pathway the what pathway, meaning that this is the part of your visual brain that's trying to determine the identity of an object you see in your visual field, and the where pathway, which is trying to extract information about its location or if it's moving its trajectory. So in that sense, I think you're right. You could say, if you were willing to divide it up a little more functionally, that on that basis there were three visual systems in our brain. However, the what and the where pathways are in a way subsets of the modern system.
All right. I hope that gets the question. Let's go to another caller here, line number two. This is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I may be jumping ahead to a later stage of organization that you were getting to, but I've always spoken with people about a particular form of automatic behavior that everyone seems to have gone through, and no one seems to appreciate as a sign not of our working well, but of our working less than ideally. And that's the phenomenon of starting out for a destination, whether driving, walking, however you're going, and being distracted by a thought or some event that you notice, and you suddenly realize you've gotten back home. Or you've gotten to work. That wasn't the original destination, but somehow on an autopilot, without accidents, without any problems, you've gotten to where you're used to going on a routine basis. Has that part of the organization structure you were going to discuss?
Well, I wish I could tell you that there was a particular aspect of brain anatomy that I could say underlies that particular well-known and frustrating function, but there isn't. I guess what I can speak to is a more general issue here, and this relates not only to our performance of actions, but even more specifically to our memories, and that is this. We have a large repertoire of things we can do in the world, and we have a large repertoire of experiences that we go to store in our brain to create our memories. And the issue is that we are not well served by just writing them all down in perfect detail on a large hard drive in our heads. We take information that comes into our brains, and we render it generic. We take similar occurrences, and we mush them together. And so, for example, if you've been to the beach once in your life, you're very likely to remember it in great detail. But if you've been to the beach 100 times, you are very likely not to remember the particular details of your 74th visit. You will have mashed this together with your other experiences. And I think this is a general idea that happens in brain function. For economy, We don't dedicate a separate circuit in the brain to every individual memory, every experience, every plan for action. We have to, because we only have so many nerve cells and connections between them with which to store and execute this information, render things in a generic manner. And perhaps that, in part, is what underlies how we fall into these action patterns where we find ourselves inexplicably back home when we're trying to navigate in the world.
But it's not anatomical.
No, there really isn't. I can't say that there's a part of your brain that underlies that particular function. And we know that this is more likely to occur as we age, but we don't know explicitly what it is in aging that renders that. In other words, we know in general how some things that tend to occur in the brain and the ways in which neurons and connections between neurons are lost as we age, but it's a rather vague description. We can't say, well, there's this location in the brain, and as we age, it changes in this way, and it underlies that particular behavioral phenomenon.
Hmm. Well, that behavior has always struck me as an example of how we are less than optimized. Are there any other?
Well, you know, I think it's a two-edged sword. In other words, when we think about things being rendered generic, it is, in a way, it's frustrating, and it leads to problems, particularly in things like the legal system, where you're trying to rely upon eyewitness testimony. A great example of this comes in the case of the Oklahoma City bombings. I think anyone who was around at that time remembers in the news John Doe number 2. There was this police identification sketch of this rather simian-looking fellow who was supposed to be Timothy McVeigh's accomplice, and he was never found. Now, the story behind this is that this sketch was provided by an employee at a place where Timothy McVeigh rented one of the or bought some of the parts he used in the bombing. And this person said, I saw Timothy McVeigh come in, and he was in here with his other guy, and here's what he looks like, so you better find him. But what they were able to reconstruct ultimately was that John Doe number 2 had been in the previous day with a guy who looked vaguely like Timothy McVeigh, but wasn't. Then the next day, or a few days later, Timothy McVeigh came in, but this fellow had conflated these two occurrences to render it into a generic memory, something we all do all the time, and this is what led to the misidentification. So that's a way in which it's kind of obviously bad, but one thing to keep in mind is that memory is only useful to us when it is rendered generic to some degree, when it is cross-linked, when we can access it with stimuli that are very different than the ones that laid it down. So, for example, right now, if I say, think of your mother's face, the stimulus that has to bring to mind that is very different than the one that laid down the trace of your mother's face. So memories are adaptive by being rendered a bit generic, but it also degrades the information to some degree. And what our brains have to do, to some extent, is to walk the line between those two.
Mm. May I ask one more, or am I in a long line?
Well, you actually are in a long line.
Thank you.
Thanks, okay. Thanks for the call. Thanks for being so considerate. We're already at our midpoint here. Again, our guest is David Linden, professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, and is the author of the recent book, The Accidental Mind. It's about the brain. How it came to be as it is and how it functions. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I think I will just go on and give some more folks a chance to talk with you and go next to Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi. Go back to the visual system a minute. It's even more than three. You realize that there are two kinds of vision. One to detect light and the other to detect detail. And you're going to argue, I'm sure, that this is all encased in the retina, which it is. The periphery of the retina has large ganglionic fields, and that detects light, and the center of the retina has small ganglionic fields and is a lousy light detector, but great for detail. But the thing is, the retina, I would argue, is brain tissue, or at least central nervous system tissue, because when you destroy it, it doesn't regenerate, unlike the peripheral nervous system. So really, you got these other two layers to the visual system, in addition to blind sight and the other that you talked about. But you're raising some fantastic questions in this program. I love it.
All right. Well, you, Professor Linden, you want to respond to that?
Yes. No, I think you're absolutely correct. And there are multiple channels of information that occur in the visual, even in the modern visual system. And there's another one that's actually really interesting. So we all know about how our experience of living in day and night is important for setting our biological rhythms. And it turns out that we have a circadian clock in our brain in a portion of the base of the brain called the hypothalamus. Now, that clock has to change subtly in the summer and the winter to adapt ourselves to shorter, long days. Now, it turns out that there is yet another pathway that leads from the retina to the clock in the hypothalamus to convey visual information. And this pathway is interesting because it's not concerned with determining the identity or location of objects in the world at all. Really, all it wants to do is say, what is the overall ambient light level going on? And this system then can be used in a non-image-forming part of vision to entrain our circadian clock. So certainly the visual system does get fragmented into these two general ancient and modern systems, but then the modern system can be subdivided in all kinds of interesting ways to extract different forms of information.
All right, let's go on again to Farina. This is line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for the great show again. What a topic. I've got a boatload of questions in my mind, but let me start with on memory, there's a common phrase that if you were in the counterculture in the 60s, that if you remember it, you weren't there. And I think that's disinformation. I can remember LSD experiences in the late 60s and early 70s very clearly, and whereas I can't remember things that happened, you know, a month ago. And on that topic, the government seems to have shut down brain research on LSD and other psychedelics that seem to be promising in various aspects, including addiction negation. Okay, that's something I'd like you to comment on. If there's any restart of any of the research with the psychedelic type of chemicals, because it seems so much of an unlocking of relative, you know, revelation experiences and insights for the people that experience those. Also, and could you talk about Alzheimer's research? And that's my two big questions.
Okay. Well,
so let me
try. They are big questions. Yes.
Let me try to unpack those. So the first thing you mentioned, you were talking about how in your own personal experience, and this is one that's shared by many people, your distant memories can oftentimes be clearer than your recent memories. And this is a very interesting phenomenon, and it reveals a fundamental aspect of the organization of memory. It seems as if when we initially experience things, they are stored in a short-term form, and that short-term form is fairly easily disrupted. It is labile. And then through time, through a process that is called consolidation, some, but not all, of that memory gets written into long-term memory. And that long-term memory is much less subject to disruption. So, for example, if you receive, let's say, electroconvulsive shock as a therapy for depression, you're very likely to lose your memory for a few hours or maybe a day or two before the shock. The same thing can happen with large doses of anti-anxiety drugs like Versed or Valium given in medical procedures. They produce a brief, what's called retrograde amnesia, that is amnesia stretching in the past for the time leading up to the experience. And that is because the Valium or the electroconvulsive shock can disrupt these forms of short-term memory, of shorter-term memory that are more labile. However, they can't disrupt those memories that were laid down further in the past, that have been consolidated and made more permanent. Now, this sort of thing is revealed to some degree in both Alzheimer's disease and in normal aging. So older folks often have a much better memory for what happened 30 years ago that's been written into this permanent form than they do for what happened the day before. There is a very, very famous case in neuropsychology of a man who is known by his initials H.M., who, in order to relieve his intractable epilepsy, underwent surgery in which a portion of the brain called the hippocampus and some of the tissues surrounding it were removed on both sides of his brain. And what happened is that he lost his memory going back into the past a couple of years, his memory for facts and events. Before that, his memory is utterly intact, but because this part of the brain is important for laying down new memories for facts and events, he couldn't store any new information for more than a few tens of minutes. So if you met him one day, you went away, and you came back the next day, it would be like he was meeting you for the first time. And so this reveals, I think, that general organization of the structure of memory. Now, if I can speak to the other issue about research on psychedelic and other both mood and perception altering drugs, it's true that historically there was a large degree of very legitimate psychiatric research that was done with these drugs before they were made illegal. So, for example, LSD in the early 60s, when it was still legal, was explored as an adjunct to psychotherapy. And there are some reports that in some cases it was quite effective. There's a lot of work that the drug ecstasy can be used for people with certain personality disorders and for people in fearful states about social situations. And it's true that most of this research has been shut down or been made very, very difficult. However, you know, this I think while there is probably something to be gained from some of these lines of research, you have to be very, very careful with it, because this is largely research being done with human subjects. And so if you are to be administering a hallucinogen to subjects, even those that have given their informed consent, you have to be concerned that in some cases people are going to have very adverse reactions. So I think there's a reason to be cautious about this, but there's probably some degree of research with drugs that have been made illegal in the United States that could be quite beneficial.
Just to stay just for a second, and I promise we have the other callers we'll get to, with the subject of memory. Human memory, certainly the capacity of human memory is remarkable. The amount of stuff that we can remember is truly, truly staggering.
Yeah.
At the same time, we know that we can't remember everything that ever happened to us, and it's a good thing, because eventually our capacity for storage would get cluttered with all sorts of things that really aren't that important. How do we make the decision, if that's an appropriate kind of way of framing the question, about the things that end up in short-term memory? How do we make the decision that that's important and we want to hold on to it, and so we need to incorporate that into our long-term memory?
Well, so that's a great question. What gets consolidated and what gets thrown away? So first of all, let me speak to this initial issue. In other words, some people have the idea that everything we experience is stored in our brains, and if we could only get access to it through meditation or hypnosis or whatever, that we could recall everything that ever happened every day of our lives. And that is absolutely and completely untrue. So there is information that we store in our brains that we can't always access, and some of that information can be aided in its recall by phenomena like meditation and hypnosis. But it's not like we have a complete record, a completely faithful record of our lives there in our brain that we can only get to if we have certain cognitive tricks to get there. So then, given that, what gets kept and what gets thrown away? Well, it's a complicated question. We don't really know the answer entirely, but one thing that we do know is that one of the things that is most important in determining what gets stored in memory faithfully is our emotion system. In other words, emotion is a way of the brain saying, what you're experiencing right now is important, it's salient, it will be useful to you later in your life, so you better write this memory down. So things that are joyous or fearful or otherwise engage emotional systems in our brains are very, very likely to be stored with great fidelity. And the classic example of this is, I'm sure all your listeners can recall exactly where they were when they learned the news of 9/11. That's because that information was very emotionally resonant, and it gotten written in to their memory with great fidelity. So emotion is kind of the now print signal for memory. It says, this is important, write it down and underline it.
All right, let's go on to talk with some other folks and go next to Champagne, line 3. Hello.
Yes, I hope you haven't already covered this, but I wondered if there was any truth to the, I hate to speak in averages, but how people use on average 10% of their brain, and if so, what is the reasoning, or is there a reasoning behind that? And I'll go ahead and listen offline. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Well, I'm very glad that you brought that up, because actually I use an anecdote about this in the prologue to my book. And if I'm introduced at a party to someone and they say, oh, this is David, he's a brain researcher, people's eyes kind of roll up in their head for a second and they get ready to speak, and I know they're about to ask that 10% of the brain question. It's something, it's a phrase that has become part of our culture, like separated at birth, 10% of the brain. And I've spoken to a lot of brain researchers over the years. I've asked people, how do you think this 10% of the brain thing came to be? And no one actually seems to know what the origin is of this. So let's unpack this question a bit. So if are you to say, well, if in the course of the day you were able to say what percentage of the neurons in our brain ever got used in the course of the day, the answer would probably be 99.9%. In other words, there aren't neurons that are just sitting in your brain, nerve cells or regions of your brain that are just sitting there that never get used. That's just not the case. What is the case is that at any given moment in time, a rather small fraction of your neurons are active. But that's not a bad thing. You don't want all the neurons. If all the neurons in your brain were active simultaneously, your brain function would be utterly compromised. It would be like if all the pixels on your television set showed all their colors simultaneously and things used to saw a blank white screen, there would be no informational content whatsoever. So I think many of you have probably seen in magazines pictures that show brain scanners where they show different regions of the brain being activated by different tasks. And this is your brain when you're listening to words, and this is your brain when you're getting ready to make a movement, and this is your brain during a panic attack. And you can see various little parts of the brain lighting up more than others, showing that they are more active. And that, at a crude level, is a fairly accurate representation. Fairly small bits of our brain are active at once. I think what people really mean when they say the phrase, is it true that we only use 10% of our brains, what they want to say is it true that we can be better than we are? Can we improve our mental function somehow? Can we use a higher percentage of our brain and therefore function better? And to some extent, that is true, particularly as we get older. Using your cognitive capacity, undergoing mental exercise as well as physical exercise will improve your mental function to some degree, and that's something we can all benefit from. But sadly, the 10% of our brain thing really doesn't have much basis in reality otherwise.
All right. Let's talk next with someone in Champaign County, line 2. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I have sort of a, go back to sort of the structure, and I have sort of a specific question and then more of a general question. The specific question goes back to when you were talking about how they're sort of parallel channels from through the optic nerve. Hey, looking at that, and are these dedicated like retinal segments in some way, or is it mutable or something? I mean, I'm wondering, I'm sure rapid movement would probably be one of the ones that you, you know, it's hooked in at a pretty basic level because you want to know if something's going to jump up and eat you, I guess, or
well,
flood
so the,
you. But if I might get the general question and then I'll hang up and listen on the air, is there are certain sort of theories of mine that have more or less been publicly offered in a variety of ways. I guess Freud has superego, ego, id. There are people that talk about, you know, that's your reptilian brain, you have to overcome it. There's bicamerality and the cutting of the corpus callosum. Are those kind of things that you could stress in sort of a structural way with any new insights from research? And I have a boatload, too, but I guess I will hang up and listen.
Okay.
Thank
well,
you.
Thanks for the questions.
Okay. Well, I'll go to the second question first. So first of all, the Freudian conception of id, superego, and ego, there is no neuroanatomical correlate that we know of that tripartite mental division. What we do know is that Freud's notion about processes that are subconscious was more or less correct. And that is basically, I talked about how the evolutionarily older, physically lower down parts of the brain are ones that we share with, for example, reptiles. Most of those processes lower in the brain are ones that are outside of our conscious control. So, for example, our automatic sensors for our breathing and heart rate and body temperature, we really can't control them very well. We can modulate our breathing and heart rate, but we don't have them entirely under our conscious control. There are forms of learning that can go on in structures like the amygdala, which is an emotion center, and the cerebellum, which is a motor center, that are, again, outside of our conscious control. We will behave in a certain way after certain forms of learning, no matter what we want to do. And then as we go to the higher parts of the brain, particularly the neocortex, then we get access to our conscious experience. And this is the part of the brain that where our conscious experience resides. So I guess that is sort of the neuroanatomical correlate that I could offer that might best address Freud. Now, the question you asked about the retina is also very interesting. And so if you say there are several channels of visual information coming from the retina to the visual parts of the brain, the interesting thing is that they aren't organized in segments. It's not like one patch of the retina does one thing and another patch of the retina does another, although there is some organization so that the center of our retina is good for visual detail and color and the periphery is good for motion and luminance. But what we now know is that there are different classes of neurons that are spread all over the retina that subserve different functions. And so they tile, if you will, the surface of the retina in multiple overlapping ways. So your entire visual field has the access to do many different kinds of analysis of visual information.
All right, let's go to Rantoul, next caller. Line one, hello. Is there a caller there, line one in Rantoul? Perhaps not. That person can call back or other people can call. We have about 7-8 minutes left in this hour of focus with David Linden, professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He's author of the book The Accidental Mind, How Brain Evolution Has Given Us Love, Memory, Dreams, and God. It is published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. Going back to the question that the previous caller raised, There is the thing that we call the brain. It is a physical structure. We can hold it in our hands. We can cut it into pieces. We can look at it. We can image it, and we can ask people to do things, and we can watch it work. Then there's this thing that's called the mind, This is something completely different. You can't hold that in your hand. It is a whole different thing. But one of the many interesting and difficult questions that brain researchers study is, can we try to understand how it is that the physical structure that we know of as the brain gives rise to the mind?
Right. Well, so that is, you know, that is the fundamental. If you were to distill what is the goal of brain research into one sentence, that would probably be a very good distillation that you just offered. I think the important thing to realize is that when people hear brain scientists say, well, this mental function or this perception or this particular aspect of our experience is located to is determined by this particular portion of the brain or neurochemical system in the brain, it's very easy to imagine that the flow of information is one way. That is to say that the structure and chemical and electrical aspects of our brain determine our experience. But that is really missing something very crucial. In other words, the physical and chemical structure of our brain determines our experience, but our experience also determines the physical and chemical structure of our brains. Our modern brains are unique, well, I wouldn't say unique, but have evolved gradually to be very plastic, that is to say, to be modulated by experience. So as you go through your life in the world, your brain is fine-tuned, if you will, by your experiences, and your experiences are written into memory using the same neurochemical systems that are involved in fine-tuning the brain early, say, in the first 5 years of life. And it is this that gives us our human individuality. What's fascinating to me is that we now know at a molecular level the general notion about how experience is written into the brain. We know that genes, where are the information for coding the proteins in our cells are located, have control elements called promoters or enhancers. And we know that those promoters, for example, can have their activity turned up or down by the electrical activity of neurons, and that electrical activity is driven in large part by our experiences, our sensory experiences out in the world. So this is the molecular substrate for how causality in the brain is a two-way street, how not only our brain structure and function determines our experience, but how our experience determines our brain structure and function.
We have a couple of other callers. We'll try to get at least one, if not both. Savoy is next, line one. Hello.
Hi, I think I can be quick. What department are you in, Doctor?
I'm in the Department of Neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine.
Most excellent, and you're doing a most excellent job. I wanted to make one brief point that the average listener is probably not aware of. You probably are, but you did let it slip by. Just because there's a report about something, and even if it's in a good journal, that still doesn't mean it was correct. And worse, it doesn't mean that the news media will pick it up and repeat it as correct. And I'm sort of referencing some of those LSD articles of the past. That's all I had to say. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I guess you can't really argue with what the caller says. I'm sure that both of those things are quite correct.
Absolutely.
All right. Let's go to Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hello, is this line? Is that me?
Yes.
Okay, great. I was wondering if you could tell me about the how much of a development of the brain during the first, like, second to third month of pregnancy.
Well, in the second to third month of pregnancy, this is fairly early in brain development, and sort of the basic divisions of the brain are being laid down. The brain starts as a sheet of cells. The nervous system starts as a sheet of cells that kind of fold over to make a hollow tube, and then that tube elongates, and one end becomes the spinal cord, and the other end becomes the brain. And the end that becomes the brain starts to fold and crumple up, and then various parts in the fold become elaborated to ultimately become some of the parts of the brain we discussed, the cerebellum, the baseball thing, the size thing that hangs off the back, the brain stem, where a lot of our basic functions that we share with lizards are located, more centrally some of the emotional and memory centers of the brain, and at the top and the front are hugely elaborated human neocortex. But during the second and third month of life, a lot of what is going on is that many, many nerve cells are being born. There is furious proliferation of cells. So you need a lot of cells to build the brain. Ultimately, the adult human brain has about 100 billion nerve cells in it. So a lot of what's going on early in pregnancy is just cells dividing like mad to give rise to the mass of neurons that will constitute the structure. And the further elaboration occurs later in pregnancy and occurs actually doesn't end with pregnancy. But the reason that human children have such a long childhood compared to other animals and are so helpless for so many years is because our big brains have to keep developing substantially after birth.
We, I'm sorry to say, are going to have to stop. One caller we can't take. I appreciate the questions people have asked. If you have others, you might look at the book that we have talked about. You might indeed find the answer there, because there's a lot in this book that we have not talked about. Again, it is titled The Accidental Mind, How Brain Evolution Has Given Us Love, Memory, Dreams, and God, by our guest David Linden. He is professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. His book is published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. And Professor Linden, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on. It's been a lot of fun.